I'm Joe Harrington, still, yet again. It's my pleasure and challenge to introduce Ben Friedlander, who is a man of many gifts, and I would say is a kind of paradigm of the new breed of poet critics in the U.S. His poetry is amazingly varied in form. It's playful, thoughtful, concise, and immense, and often very serious, too, as we heard this morning. His criticism is astute in its form as well as its content. For instance, an essay by him about Marianne Moore incorporates comments and objections from several different readers, which he includes in the essay, and then it alters the course of the argument in response to those comments. His editorial work has rendered an invaluable service to American poetry, and his blog posts on the blog, The Poetry in the Age of Whitman and Dickinson, were oftentimes much more informative and demonstrated more acumen than a lot of peer-reviewed articles I've read. And his Facebook posts are very scholarly and interesting, and more so than a lot of blog posts I've read. So there you have it. He is Associate Professor of English at the University of Maine in Orono and a member of the editorial collective of the National Poetry Foundation. His numerous poetry books include A Knot Is Not a Tangle, and more recently, The Missing Occasion of Saying Yes, which is a selection of several of his previous collections, and the longer, very major work, 100 Etudes, is going to be coming out sometime soon, I think. It's in production from what I hear. His prose includes the provocative and formally innovative simulcast Four Experiments in Criticism, among others, and he has edited collections of prose by Charles Olson, Larry Eigner, and poetry by Robert Creeley. His talk today is entitled The Walk to the Paradise Garden. Please help me welcome Ben Friedlander to Urbiland.
Thank you. Thank you. One thing follows another incessantly. This I would posit as the first principle of Kenneth Irby's poetry, one of the qualities of attention he shares with Whitman. Accretion matters, but also, and this perhaps is a second principle, the line we cross to meet things matters, or rather gives to matter that hallucinatory quality dreams have when they surprise us by waking us up. But line is not quite the right word for characterizing the thresholds where attention quickens. For a line, that is a line of poetry, is what crosses a border, by which I mean that the work of a line is not establishment but movement. Perception is active, an encounter with the world, and this encounter is itself a thing that poetry records. Self-reflexivity swells the accretion. The world, of course, has a temporal aspect as well as a spatial one, and perception necessarily shares in both, meeting the world where the two coincide. Again and again, perception brings us to a crossroad, a complex interplay of history and geography, memory and presence, a complexity given narrative and thematic expression in Irby's early poetry. His later poetry instead develops a formal expression of this complexity, resulting in texts that are extraordinarily private, having less in common with storytelling than list-making, an act of attention at once expansive and compressed. The experience of such texts, a third principle, is a paradoxical combination of traversal and dwelling. Their rule is graduction, to use one of the spurious words from the OED, cited there as an error for graduation in two senses, division into degrees and the process of concentrating by evaporation, a portmanteau of gradation and reduction, a dream word for a dreamlike experience. All of which leads me to the walk to the Paradise Garden. But before I explain what I mean by that, let me make three digressions through Irby's poetry in order to illustrate the three principles I have listed, which I would name for simplicity's sake, accretion, crossing, and experience. The first of these principles, accretion, ties perception to growth. As a principle of writing, it means that poetry lives by taking in and setting forth, extending its reach perception by perception, word by word. There is an essential restlessness in this. Though Zukofsky is an influence, Irby's poems are a far cry from the rested totality of objectivism. Their animation, moreover, is mimetic, a response to the real, a Heraclitean real whose varied manifestations are neatly summed in the early title Movements, Sequences. Even dreams are caught up in this flow. There is no illusory world, there is only the world, writes Irby, a credo that helps explain the following visionary passage in which the metaphor of growth is prominent. The flower that is the imagination that we live by blooms. From the flame the eyes burn down the very town we live in all our light, to know, and then build up again to give, to live in. I hear in these lines a powerful apprehension of what perception yields, articulated by a sentence that resists grasp, owing to a number of slippages in the phrasing, a characteristic I associate with the late work, though Irby accounts for it as early as the preface to Movement Sequences, the very book from which this passage comes. Speaking in that preface of the work of the imagination, conceived as a force independent of will, Irby writes, quote, "What means I have to participate at all is in the shifts and twistings of syntax, following the textures and wrenching of how words follow each other, the flow," unquote. The real has no explicit place in this formulation, but if imagination is indeed independent of will, it is in its way a force of nature. Moreover, the preface ends with a long quotation from projective verse in which language is upheld precisely as a means of joining nature. The commonplace of our age that language mediates, which makes of language a threshold that the real is obliged to pass through, has no place in Irby's poetics, though his contact with the real, sensual through and through, calls on language for help at every turn. The intensity of this contact assumes its full significance in those later poems where the accretion of perception overwhelms the help of language, so that we sense but cannot parse the continuity of experience that Irby records. Only music assures us of the wholeness of what's perceived, moment by moment, in the flow of language. A choice example of this is a queer text from 1983 in which the perception overwhelming language is, to begin with, the very attention to language that writing requires, a dizzying self-reflexivity whose one still moment is the perception of light at the end, a look up from the page, I fancy, that hands reverie over to the world it would hold. To look into the pits of and the blank of the word that does not come then is its pits. To stare into that whole season of absence in its staring. Seed of the seed that is not time, given in time into that. But what escapes from that black hole is the recent angel of awareness, shriven staring to right awareness. Fresh mounted messenger from beyond the turning of the earth's direction, back. Dithyram steward of the guardian of the bear, blazing in the forehead, plow step to turn and return the pole. Stiff is the penetrant of attention, mucoprotein gone down that drain in the altered work, flood of each single fold of the marriage host from the clothing adornment, jewel wick in the nozzle of the lamp stretched toward this midden, back, emunctory life, paranomastically answering to the root of being. Seek, seed, see it, seen, in the gleam of the sunlight off the top of the yellow capri parked beyond the dumpster, seized. The second principle, crossing, asserts that perception is an activity, even when it occurs in repose. More pointedly, it asserts that perception is the crossing of a threshold, such that stories of crossing become scenes of perception. This way of speaking might seem peculiar, or at least unnecessarily metaphorical, were it not for the singular importance of crossings in Irby's work. At least through Catalpa, which ends in a flight from Chicago to Boston, crisscrossings of the continent provide narrative inspiration, opening pathways for the senses, including the historical sense. I think my favorite of these literal crossings is the last of many that saturate for Max Douglas, the trek of the Jurassic longing saurians who make their way across the Salinian terrain of California. The tread of those dinosaurs is explicitly a conduit for vision, not only because we are told that they crossed with their tiny, nearsighted, foliage-ridden eyes, but also because we ourselves, as Irby tells us, are the inheritors of that gaze, presumably because we are able to walk the same path. By accident or design, there is even a crossing in the first line of the first poem, which is not chronologically the earliest, in Irby's collected poems. This is the opening to the Roadrunner poem, a powerful act of perception whereby the object perceived becomes invested with the perceiver. The senses are that powerful in Irby's work. They do not merely give us the world, they project us into it. The roadrunner that crossed my yard, and the roadrunner my neighbor kept as a pet, and the grain I am sunk into, staring into the wood, the bowl in my hands, the windowsill. Catch me as I go out along the plowed fields and stare there back at me as I, at them, went in, came out. The crossing of the roadrunner in the yard would hardly be noteworthy on its own. It becomes significant as the initiation of a chiasmus that Irby completes by crossing back. And here, if time permitted, I would cite Merleau-Ponty on the chiasm of perception, a posthumous note first published in France the same year that Irby's poem was published in the United States. These thematic treatments of crossing scarcely hint at the pervasiveness of the thresholds we encounter in Irby's work. Here again, I would cite the pertinence of the early title movement sequences, since wherever a movement or sequence occurs, there is implicitly a crossing. Movement is the more encompassing category, since there can be no traversal of space that does not include a traversal of time. But even a motionless sequence involves a location in space. Our existence is always both spatial and temporal. Hence, at every moment in our lives, we find ourselves at a crossroad. Irby attests to the potency of what these arrivals disclose in a short prose piece about a Japanese form of divination, in which the questioner goes to a well-traveled road at evening, taking the first overword heard words as his or her oracle. In certain poems, it seems that the whole long length of the reel is such a road, and all of the senses, not merely the ears, alert to its divination. And this is a poem that Joe cited this morning. The sidewalks are all dried after the rain, except for the dark shadow around the dead squirrel, splayed out as though supplicating the concrete. Fur of the spine ridge, fur of the tail curled up along the spine ridge, frayed up, rat gray and gnat thickened. Yesterday, late afternoon, a few yards away, it was sitting in the bare dirt, head bent down to the earth, bitten in the neck or by the quickest plague, or simply the heart gone dropped in mid-jump. Carried in the night play by the same catch and turned around, so now to face me. The third principle, experience, speaks to the character of the texts Irby produces in consequence of the first two principles, by which I mean in particular the experience of the late work, poetry that seizes on the secrets of crossing and accretion, of perception as encounter and writing as its means or witness, in order to encompass and condense the real, or rather that portion of the real that Irby's acts of attention and powers of language are able to disclose. Quote, "Not having made the world, I have created it anew each morning, in confusion, act, acts, axis." The axis I take as the crossroad of time and space, memory and presence, where perception occurs, recreating the world and placing us in it, as upon waking. The act I take as our material engagement with the world, the engagements of art certainly included, for these lines come from a poem about revolution, also about the pages of revolution, turned in bed while hearing Bach and thinking of Pound. The ambiguous axe between axis and act is what confusion wields, a tool of destruction or construction, separating, that is, making distinctions between, the very things it fuses. This is the impossible task of reduction, a measuring out of the Heraclitean real that also, somehow, collapses its dimensions, a project best realized for me in the poems of Ridge to Ridge and Studies. Here, for instance, is a short poem from the former book titled To Almost Midnight New Year's Eve in Glasgow. It begins with a fine distinction that sets us deep into a darkness where the eyes falter, though the other senses, especially touch and hearing, compensate. Or maybe it is the memory of those other senses. Memory, in any case, lights up this darkness, sending us well beyond the coordinates of the title, an overload of sensation perfectly captured in the last line. Into the dark before the dark, before the years, the old pants velour touch to the new unknown belongs. As if there were no grown set worry and no undressing out enough, old skin leopard teddy bear witchery of variations memory, and the hat, even the feather tango, each nut, each sip, a look into the ear, incapable smartness, unpredictable calling, old cold metal tumbler the lip just sticks to, Coca-Cola lifesavers from before the war, accrual, and that soft mezza voce tuba languor and arousal in the rapt aphasic ear. Which brings me at last, the rapt aphasic ear does, to the Paradise Garden, or rather, to the walk that leads to the Paradise Garden, an epoch in the life of the imagination to which I was first introduced by Irby's poem Delius, about the composer Frederick Delius. The walk to the Paradise Garden is Delius's most famous composition, an intermezzo from the opera A Village Romeo and Juliet, adapted from Gottfried Keller's novella of the same name. The Paradise Garden is a tavern frequented by the poor and disreputable, an ironic name for Keller. Delius's vision is cannier. His tavern stands at the edge of a paradise only available to those who have fallen, a vicissitude from which his fallen lovers shrink. Yet they find themselves tempted. Their wordless walk to this fallen paradise is the opera's crucial moment. But setting aside for a moment its narrative content, though this content is of course central to our experience, I would describe the intermezzo as an operatic equivalent to Irby's Reduction. It characterizes the interval opened up between two discrete scenes while compressing within that space the emotional impact of the opera as a whole. Irby's synopsis of the opera, or rather his synopsis of the second half, actually downplays the walk, emphasizing instead a dream that the two lovers share, uncannily, a coincidence of experience that draws their dream into the shared world of waking reality. Sally and Vreli before the fire, both dreamt the same dream, heard the choir, and saw the entwining cathedral light marry them, grown up and child, couples crowned together, and so awoke and left, already on their way out of this world. Passed through the fair of worldly, fair and wondrous things, and made the walk to the Paradise Gardens. That is all we ever hear from the opera, the long walk. Nothing of the Caspar David Friedrich Church, dream music, the gardens full of whirling dope fiend bohemians behind the dark fiddler, the lovers floating off in a coal barge and fucking into oblivion. This is the most heartbreaking music in the world. Which is a quote in the poem. What Irby says here about the dream reiterates the credo I cited before. There is no illusory world, there is only the world. A statement that appears in his book The Flower of Having Passed Through Paradise in a Dream. That this flower-bearing paradise, which dreams traverse, may have something to do with Delius's paradise garden, a kind of limit, is suggested to me by a subsequent passage in the poem for Delius, an explicit reference to the credo, and a beautiful summation of what the opera expresses. Quote, "Only a sensualist could so trap the pain of parting, the endlessness of the moment of leaving, this world, this only world, for nothingness." Unquote. Irby has in mind here the opera's final moment, in which the lovers drown while consummating their passion, but the endlessness he mentions captures perfectly for me the apprehension and expectation that linger in the walk, states of mind that swell to a melancholic grandeur in Delius's music. In citing this music, I do not mean to offer it as a further illustration of the three principles. Its pertinence for me lies instead in a revelation of the nature of art as expression. For one important aspect of the walk is the fact that it arises in the context of an adaptation. Though Delius's libretto transforms Keller's novella in significant ways, the walk, for instance, is only implied in Keller's narrative, is not described, the relationship of the opera to the novella is such that every expressive moment within it acquires, for those who know both, the hallucinatory power of a dream that haunts the waking world that shapes the dream in the first place. Such hauntings are all pervasive in Irby's work, which is unusually erudite, without, however, requiring footnotes to be appreciated. His art is not a commentary on its sources, but an adaptation of them, as dreams are an adaptation of everyday life. There are exceptions to this, and Irby's poem for Delius is in fact one of them. But by and large, his writing is a kind of dream work, one in which the borders between dream and waking, between art and life, are constantly crossed. Taking the walk to the Paradise Garden as a model for poetry leads me, then, to understand Irby's art as inextricably tied to the work of adaptation. The adaptation involved in his art is not usually so literal as in the intermezzo that Delius composed for his own version of Keller's story, which was itself an adaptation of Shakespeare's story. But insofar as anything given expression must be felt, and so known, there is inevitably a process of taking possession involved. In this sense, even self-expression is a form of adaptation, a mode of cognition whereby artists adapt themselves to art. This, I think, is one of the things that Irby means by étude, a type of poem that he gives its own section in Call Steps and that fills a whole book in Studies, whose title is a translation of étude, a word that also names, and this is noteworthy, a type of music. It is the fact of this study that tempts me to think of the characteristics I have described as principles, tempts me, that is, to think of this poetry, especially in its later manifestations, as the performance of a phenomenology. And so I would like to end with a poem that exemplifies Irby's phenomenology, a study drawing on all three principles, also an adaptation of experience that is itself an experience, suspended, like the walk to the Paradise Garden, within the very threshold that it traverses. The window shattered out into the storm lets in the storm, lets in the flood and its red fronded palm trees, lets in what waits at the end, lets out what waits for the end, in this room right now that takes all that has come before and waits. It's time to go home, the father time, the mother space. But all these people here already are a room as vast as presidency and as invaded, the father space, the mother time, that are not home but orders of perception, as home itself is an organ of perception, lets in the rain that music makes, lets out the tightly woven carpets of the rain, knows at the end whose red-fronded palm trees are they. Thank you.
We're now going to take a short break. At 2:45, we will rejoin here and hear some talks from Pierre Jury and from Lynn Hajanian. I also want to remind all of you or let you know the book table is no longer in the back of the room, but it has moved down to Jayhawk Inc., which is on the second floor of the Union. Each of the speakers has at least one book for sale downstairs in Jayhawk Inc. I recommend you check it out. There are also cookies and coffee and all sorts of goodness in the back. But I'll see you back here at 2:45.